You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Thursday, April the 5th. More than 50 school districts around the state had referendum questions on the ballot this past Tuesday asking voters for permission to exceed revenue caps to spend more money. Half of those questions, more than half actually, failed. The other half passed. We're going to talk about why so many schools need more money and why some of these, most of these failed, why some of them passed, why did the ones that passed pass, and we wonder what's the story in your community, in your school district. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Our guest is Steve Correa. He is an associate professor of teacher education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why did so many school districts have these referendum questions on the ballot?
Well, I think first it's helpful to understand why school districts go the referendum route to raise money. And usually the answer to that is quite as simple as looking at the Constitution. And in the state of Wisconsin, school districts have to, in almost all cases, requesting money or spending money over $1 million on a project, need to be able to request that money by the state constitution through a referendum or through a vote through the citizens that support the school district. So unlike cities or towns or other kind of municipal bodies, school districts are held to really a very high standard, keeping in touch with the local community as to whether this amount of money to be spent is acceptable to them. And so, you know, if we live in a big city and the city wants to build a pool, they can just go ahead and do that. They can float the bonds and build the pool. School districts cannot by law. So school districts have to be able to, they're consistently checked and balanced by local constituencies. So it's a very common thing for schools to have to request more money if they want to do things.
Yeah.
So that's not unusual at all.
But it is being reported that this was the largest one-day number of school referendums statewide since the school district revenue caps were implemented in 1993.
Exactly. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And I'm not a political historian, but I couldn't help but wonder if that precipitated the revenue cap program in the state of Wisconsin, if some people perhaps decided that this is a reason that we have to cap this constant requesting of money. I'm not sure about that, but I think that is interesting. But I think in the cases that happened this past election round, if we look at, there were really three ways that school district, or three types of money that the districts were asking for. The first one was for buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when a number. Now, a couple of these had price tags that make us all have our jaws drop.
Yeah.
But that's what construction costs nowadays in a lot of cases. So that one's fairly normal. Buildings get old. That's not anything, I think, anything that stands out too much, except, of course, for the price. Secondly, of course, they sometimes have to ask for operating money for those new buildings.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other one that, again, not unusual, but still expensive. Now, the third one, I think, that stands out in slightly over half the cases this particular go-round, where districts were asking for money to exceed revenue caps. And that should be a large red flag to a lot of people.
Why?
And the reason for that is, that's a very good question, the reason for that is districts just simply to keep doing what they do need to ask for more money. Now, we do have a mechanism in the state for them to do that. They put the referenda in front of their local voters to be able to exceed what they usually receive from the state. They're not expanding programs. They are not coming up with new initiatives. They're simply trying to keep in place what they have. Oh, districts like Marquesan did that previously, you know, a number of districts around the state. That means that the school funding formula that we use in the state is not allowing districts to be able to stay in place. Again, not new, not initiatives, but it's just simply something that they need to be able to do to keep doing what they're doing. And that is a big red flag, because districts now are finding that the cutbacks you know, we're down to bone. We're not cutting fat anymore in a lot of districts.
We are talking with Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. We're talking about why so many school referendum questions on the ballot on Election Day, why so many of them failed, more than half failed, and why those that passed, passed. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. We welcome the story in your school district. Good shape or not. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 17 minutes past 7 o'clock. Coming up, Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5 o'clock, Wisconsin towns hoping to protect their boundaries and control growth are backing a perennial bill in the state legislature that would put the brakes on unwelcome annexation. Ben will talk with a proponent and opponent of this after 5 o'clock. We're trying to figure out why there were so many school referendum questions on the ballot on Tuesday, and trying to figure out the outcome. Half of them passed, half of them failed, and wondering whether we're doing the right thing when it comes to our school funding formula, if so many schools have to ask to exceed these revenue caps, have to ask voters for permission to spend more money. And I'm wondering, Professor Correa, before we go to the phones, if a school district says, hey, voters of this school district, we're in trouble. If we can't exceed these revenue caps, we're going to have to cut bone, not just fat, that we've already cut everything we can cut. And in order to just keep doing what we're doing, we have to be able to exceed, spend more money. And the voters tell them no.
I think that's a really good question, because what this shows is all districts have a central office. Teachers almost talk about it mythically, but it tends to be a place where all these important decisions are made. This is an example of where you have a strong central office that really helps to foster relationships with the community, with constituencies in the school district. Those districts then have good communication back and forth about their value, their programs, what they do, and then communication with that district and the constituencies isn't the sky is falling, we need money. The communication is ongoing. That's the sign of a strong central office. Now, that takes a lot of expertise. That's public relations. There's nothing wrong with public relations. That is intelligent. You should communicate your mission and what you're doing. Well, districts, though, don't always have that kind of expertise on hand. They don't always have that finesse. They don't always have the media access. But districts that do that and do that well, then the communication isn't just, oh, I'm just hearing from them when they want money. I don't know if any of the listeners, that might be the case with some of the colleges or universities they've gone to. They just seem to contact them when they want money. Well, districts have to be able to have that communication on an ongoing basis and show their value from the start of the day to the end of the day into the evening. So districts need to be able to do that. Now, that's the value of good school leadership. Unfortunately, in a lot of these cases, some of these districts had poor school leadership, or at least not complete school leadership. It's very different to be able to lead a district on a day-to-day basis and then to be able to have a vision for the future with the financial and the educational and the mission and the changing school population. Very different sets of skills. Sometimes, though, what these poor districts have had to do, they've had bad leadership. That leadership leaves, and the new leadership is responsible for, A, getting out of the hole, and then, B, positioning the district for the future. And then when the people in the community hear, well, gosh, they're in trouble again, they want us to bail them out, hey, get your act together before you come to us. And unfortunately, that's, you know, the sign of the reality of what happens with a lot of places.
We'll go to the phones. Amy in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a teacher in the Milwaukee Public School District, and I'm astounded each year. I've been teaching for 6 years. And since I've started teaching, every year we come in and we're like, okay, we've got to shave $100,000, $200,000 off our budget. How are we going to do this? Who are we going to cut now? We don't have a reading specialist. We don't have art. We don't have music. We don't have a nurse. We don't have a school psychologist. Or she's working half time or a third time or quarter time. I don't know what she's working. Social worker, quarter time. And our kids today are coming to school with more problems, it seems to me. And schools are expected to do everything. And the public, I think, there's such a negative education for some reason gets such a bad rap ever since A Nation at Risk and now with No Child Left Behind. It seems to me that there's a move to privatize education, especially in Milwaukee with the voucher program. So it just seems like education in general isn't given, isn't valued as it should be. And then I think the way we fund education, we're pitting taxpayers against the schools. And I think we should possibly raise our sales tax in Wisconsin because it is low. I think Illinois is something like 10%, and we're only at 5.65, so I think that might be an option. But I am troubled because I'm a teacher, and I see what our kids need and what our kids deserve. And we're not educating the whole child anymore. We're expected to do more with less, and accountability measures are rising. And we're expected to do everything, and yet we're not given the funds. So I'm very concerned because I really love my job and I love my students, but I don't think we're doing the best by them.
Amy, thank you very much for the call. A lot there, Professor Correa. What do you want to react to?
Yeah, I like Amy's mentioning of Nation at Risk. Those of us that have been around a while, that's 25 years ago, so we realize this has been on the front burner, obviously, longer than that, too. But certainly the Wisconsin revenue formula and our method of funding schools has to be looked at. The problem with that is, for the average person, this is so unbelievably boring. But it's critically important. It's like the Social Security debate. Mm-hmm. It's like Medicare Part A and Part B. It is critically important, but we haven't had any changes brought to that. On the first part of what the caller shared, I thought that was really fascinating. Look at the requests that have happened with these static budgets that school districts have. Assessment, accountability, testing, a lot of unfunded mandates that have come down from the Fed to the state and then to the local districts. And I'm a big believer, big supporter in school nurses. I think that they do a huge, valuable role, and these people are saints with what they're able to deal with. And again, these are being cut. That whole child comes to school, not just the one that takes the test. So, yes, districts are doing a lot more with less, and then as everybody knows, any economist will tell you at some point the resources are not there to be able to support all the programs equally, and that's where districts are making a lot of hard choices.
Yeah. To talk a little bit about Amy's comment that they're, I don't know, that maybe the state is pitting property taxpayers versus the schools.
I think it's... I don't know that I would necessarily say pitting in terms of a contest. However, the reality of it is we have the perception of Wisconsin, and it's mostly accurate, that schools are funded through the property tax, and that is mostly accurate. The problem with that is that as the money gets redistributed from the state, then back down into the local districts, we have a funding formula that's based largely on districts that have stable or increasing enrollment. And an example of that would be the Appleton School District. Appleton is blessed with a stable or slightly increasing school enrollment. They're doing better because of that. Other rural districts, Wyoega, Fremont, they are punished with declining enrollment. Obviously, this is not their fault. But I have heard people say that this is a precursor to the 1950s consolidation movement that happened, where a lot of the districts ended up being consolidated, and well, we even had more than the 425 that we have today, and that districts may be, you know, looking at that for survival. But the reality of it is, yes, people are having increased requests for money, and the problem is people feel like they have paid enough, and districts have to be able to communicate their value to their constituencies.
Thank you, Amy. Jason in Racine is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Just listening to a professor speaking about the trimming away at now bone instead of fat.
I just used that as a question. The professor didn't say
right.
that.
I'm just saying that it's kind of irritating where people are like, well, they're trimming away all the bone, no more fat, the fat's gone. And yet you see programs continually funding 110 athletic programs for maybe a 4% of the school population, yet they're terminating English as a second language and other core curriculum, you know, to fund, you know, basket weaving. And I'll take whatever the professor has to say off the air. Mm-hmm.
I think that's very insightful, although specifically I'm not familiar with any basket weaving programs, but I think that the metaphor is perhaps apt. No, a lot of districts have, I think, and even in this most recent round of referenda, there were a few for athletic facilities. I don't suspect that those are going to do very well. Districts just have got to be able to prove their worth, and politically speaking, that squeaky wheel of athletic supporters does not carry the day in political votes. Mm-hmm. They are an important group, but they're one of many groups, and certainly districts have to reach out very, very wide. And you know, districts that support athletics, it's an important part of growth, but it's not the part that's going to make the difference to a lot of places and a lot of people. It's important for development, but, you know, does a district, do they have a wide net for athletic use? Are we including lots of people? Great case in point. Does the high school have a pool? Does the community mm-hmm. use the pool? Mm-hmm. Does the community have access to the pool? Or is this controlled? I know up north in Minocqua, Lakeland High School has gone out of their way to have the community be involved in athletic facilities and training facilities. And Eagle River just recently signed an interesting kind of program with the local technical college and then the community being involved in health and athletic facilities there. That's visionary. That's brilliant. And I think districts need to look at more of those models to be able to do that.
Mildred in Eau Claire is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Excuse me. We lived in Europe many years. And in Europe, children go to school in buildings that are 600 to 800 years old. The facilities are for learning. They're not a country club. The children come out speaking sometimes 2 and 3 different languages. And
we get you. You know what, Mildred? We get you. And I only have a little bit more than a minute before our news break. Professor Correa, Europe doesn't need to build brand new schools every other year.
No, that's true. I've visited schools in Russia and Ukraine where they don't even have running water in the bathroom. Mm. And I think I understand the context of what you said. Yes, we do have some cases where there's the Taj Mahal mentality of what some school districts have done. I don't know that I can respond directly to any specific ones, mm-hmm. but yes, school districts, I think for the most part, are pretty good at deciding what happens. We also have very stringent building codes, and asthma's on the rise, mm-hmm. and lots of things we need to be aware of. So.
Yeah, we'll leave it there for now. We will check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll continue talking with Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. We're looking at why so many school districts asked voters this week to spend more money. They asked for permission to exceed revenue caps or to build new schools. And we're wondering why that is and what happened, the outcome of those referendum questions here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine at 7:36 on this Thursday morning, April the 5th. 52 school districts in Wisconsin had referenda questions on the ballot this past Tuesday, an overall total of 73 different questions. About half of those questions failed. Voters rejected them. About half passed. And we're talking about why so many questions on the ballot this year and what wins and what doesn't, and welcoming your story from perhaps your school district. We can't go through all 52 school districts and all 73 questions, but just to give you an indication of some of the results from the State Journal, 12 South Central Wisconsin school districts were among the record 52 districts that asked voters on Tuesday for permission to spend more money. Proposals for major construction projects were rejected by voters in districts serving New Glarus, Lake Mills, and Poinette. From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, voters in neighboring Waukesha County school districts offered a split decision on Tuesday on spending measures. On the winning side, the Mukwonago schools, where residents approved referendum proposals that will boost operational revenue by $8.75 million to preserve programs over the next 5 years, plus an additional $15 million for building improvements. But the Palmyra Eagle School District lost its referendum bid, and voters soundly rejected a request for an additional $750,000 a year to help balance the district's operating budget. So what makes a school district win on one of those and these questions, and what makes it lose? How is your school district doing? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. Our guest is Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College in De Pere, and our next caller is Bill in Lancaster. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd have to disagree with the saying that sports do not carry the day. And I have an anecdote. There's a school in southwestern Wisconsin who had quarter classrooms. They were all rotten, rodent infested. They asked to build under the school, said no. Or they asked two more times over the next couple of years. Both times they said no. So for a total of three times they said no. The same day that the third referendum failed, another school in southwestern Wisconsin said, we're going to build onto the school, and we're going to do it no matter what. And in order to pay for it, if you know, we're cutting football. There's pass. So the fourth time, the first school said, okay, we're going to cut football and build classrooms if you don't pass this referendum. It passed. So now my school district about 5 years ago said, we need more money, and if you don't give us more money, we're going to cut football, band, pretty much anything. And that referendum passed. So at least in southwestern Wisconsin, football carries the day.
A reaction to that, Professor Correa?
I think that's really a great story, because really what I think what the caller's sharing is that it's multiple constituencies by any political measure that result in successful elections. You know, you don't get elected to politics, to any office, unless you have lots of people vote for you. School districts have lots of different groups within them. The band boosters are a powerful group. The football people interested in that is a powerful group. Certainly, Seymour, Wisconsin has a powerful basketball program. You need to involve those groups to get them there. Now, if in these particular districts that group was large enough and influential enough to be able to do that, then perhaps that was a politically expedient thing to do. We can talk about the value and the philosophical approach to that later. Politics is reality and a lot of pragmatism. It sounds similar to perhaps some attempts in Texas or Canton, Ohio, near where I grew up. Certainly threatening football would result in a lot of outbreak, probably the removal of the superintendent more than the passing of a levy. But in this particular case, I think that probably that district sounds like they became very, very district or very, very desperate. I would also suspect that there were multiple factors at play if this was the third time or the fourth time. But I suppose in certain cases, if it's a large enough group, they can carry it. But usually that's not the sign of a strong central office. Again, being able to communicate need across the community. That's the kind of vision and leadership that districts will be successful with more often.
Thanks, Bill. Dwight in Rock County. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, well, good morning. My background is the private sector in manufacturing, and we had in Janesville, which is the largest school district in Rock County, they didn't have a referendum this week, but they did last fall. And I compare them to the GM plant in Janesville, where when the demand for their product went up, they went to a second shift and worked some overtime. They didn't build a brand new factory or expand the factory, but the school district, you go down the street to the school district, and they have a declining enrollment projection, and now they're expanding their high schools. So it's kind of mystifying when you look at it from a private sector standpoint. The other thing they do, which is also mystifying, the UW-Madison suggests something like 22 credits in order to be admitted to that school, which I think is the fairly strict requirements. and you turn your attention to the Janesville School District, and they currently offer 195 different classes. And it kind of reminds me of Harley-Davidson when they were about ready to go bankrupt. They started putting Harley names on dirt bikes and all kinds of motorcycles. They lost their focus, and as a result, they nearly went out of business. Today, they're very successful because they concentrate on what they really do. The school districts, it's almost as if it's a child-driven curriculum where any course you know, might strike your fancy, they'll offer. And instead of concentrating on those things that will help that child later, classes like recreational animals, for instance, which takes up a classroom, displaces a class in English or a second language, and it's kind of crazy when you look at it from the outside.
Mm-hmm. Professor Correa?
Well, I think that the first comments that the caller made about the initial changes that happened in Janesville, although I can't speak with that with personal experience, but if that characterization is correct, really, if you look at districts that do that, unfortunately, those buildings are primarily used 8-3. Now, you look at districts that are successfully connected with the community, those buildings are used all day long. They're used into the evening. There's nothing magical that classes can't be offered at different times during the day. Visionary districts do that. Now, for a different rationale, Green Bay Preble High School is now looking at doing two different shifts of schools because of overcrowding. One could argue about the Green Bay High School being needed, but the reality of it is they're taking an existing resource and spreading that out to be able to be used in the course of the day. That, I think, is very intelligent. It's pragmatic. So there's nothing magical about this 8-3 day and having the community be a part of that. Now, the other topic that the caller mentioned, I think this is a great topic because we have specific minimal requirements that state universities require. The gentleman said 22 credits. But a lot of districts exceed that, and perhaps that vision was in a day about, well, we don't want our graduates to meet minimum requirements. We don't want that to be the floor. We want to be able to reach a ceiling of wonderful expectations. Now, that's a whole different set of requirements. That's a different set of issues. And I think that to be able to be involved in those decisions, again, that's a district communicating with the community. Here's what we do. I don't know specifically about the animal course, but you know, that's where people get involved in the community. Why do we offer this? What does this have to do? No Child Left Behind does not encourage those kind of diverse offerings. So perhaps that might be a result of that. We're going to have a scaling back of those kind of requirements.
We're talking about Tuesday's election, which had the largest one-day number of school referendums statewide since the school district revenue caps were implemented in 1993. More than 52, I believe, school districts put questions on the ballot, more than 73 questions on the ballot. Did your school district ask you for permission to build a new school this week, or perhaps permission to exceed the state-set caps on spending for operational costs? How did you vote, and why? 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Half of those questions failed on Tuesday. Half or so passed. We're talking with our guest about why this all is and what it means. Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 12 minutes before 8 o'clock. Coming up after 8, I will welcome in the author of the recently published book, The N-Word. Who can say it, who can't, and why? That's coming up after 8 o'clock. We're talking about all those school referenda questions on the ballot this week, asking voters for permission to build new schools or to exceed spending limits. And we are talking with Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Let me talk to you about this example, Professor Correa. It was the largest school referendum in state history, according to WEAC. Voters in New Richmond this week approved spending $93 million to purchase land and to build a new elementary school and high school. But then those same voters rejected a separate $2.5 million referendum to exceed the revenue limits for operating costs of the new schools. So what's going to happen there?
I thought that was just a fascinating election result. You often might have thought that could have been just the opposite. Again, I can't speak to the specific example, but I would think that would be a case where the facilities were clearly in need of updating or improvement, and that the district had some vision about what they wanted to do. It's also possible. You know, districts can be very careful with how they word these, how they package them, what they put into them. In other words, they can really make it almost the old classic First Amendment that has everything from speech to religion in it, or they can tease them out with very specific individual questions that require multiple votes. It's possible that the voters looked at the numbers. The first one might have been the high school or the larger cost. By the time they got to the second one, they just said, hey, we just gave you this. Figure out how to do it. Now, the reality of it is, though, that really puts that district in a hard spot because they have a, well, they will have a probably a quite impressive facility, but they're going to have trouble in their day-to-day operations. Now, they were asking for that. Now, that's how the district chose to package it, how they chose to word it, how they chose to place it on there. But that is going to be quite a vexing problem for that district because they have a facility, but whether or not they're going to be able to operate it to the capacity that they need, that certainly would seem to be in jeopardy.
Kurt in Waukesha is with us. Hi, Kurt.
Yeah, I was. I'm on the Waukesha School Board, and our position is basically has been since we failed our referendum in 2005, is that people have to first see the cuts and the damages from failed referendums before they'll realize what they've lost. And by then, we don't even know if they'll even vote for a referendum even after that. I don't think it's just a communication issue. It is somewhat because we have talk radio here going against this almost constantly. But the bottom line is people just don't believe we need the money, and they'd rather see us prove that we have to make these cuts first.
You're talking about talk radio in your region on AM commercial stations, right, Kurt?
Yes, I am.
Okay, not this talk radio.
Well, you know, your talk radio doesn't quite carry as much weight in this area as that talk radio.
Yeah. Thanks for that. we get you a reaction, Professor Correa.
I think that the caller brings up a very good point. And what that is, there's a whole level of expertise that school districts need that these people don't necessarily have because they're trained to lead schools and be educators, and that's political awareness, how to get a referendum passed, and then this idea of polling constituencies, finding out need, meeting those needs. And if we look at what's recently happened with a lot of successful candidates with fundraising, can you imagine if we were that successful with schools? That would be a great thing to do. These people have a lot of people with expertise to be able to do that. School districts do not. So instead, we play the sky is falling game in a lot of cases, and so it's the cry, oh, we have to fill it. There's a deficit. Here it is. Here's the result of your negligence. Now, that works some in the short term, but again, school districts need to be able to have that long-term vision and communicate that. That's just politics, by the way. That's not my magical world saying that. And districts that can do that, though, are going to have long-term success with their district. If anybody's ever been to court, an attorney will never ask a question they don't know the answer to. If a district isn't sure that they can't get a levy or fairly sure they can't get it passed, they probably shouldn't be trying. It sends a very bad message. It's easier to continue to say no. But this takes school districts in an area that is new, or at least it's not a skill set that they have, and that's political awareness and how to operate successfully in the political arena. This is a very varied skill set. It also shows a very impressive superintendent that's able to put that team together. Those people are rare, and when you get them, you should keep them hugely. They are valuable.
Thank you, Kurt. Deborah in Greendale. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'm a school principal and have been in education for 35 years, and I appreciate very much the dialogue that's going on. Our school district, I'm a principal in Antioch, Illinois. Our district is up for a referendum next week for a building referendum. I agree wholeheartedly with the idea that we need visionary leaders. Without vision, the people perish. However, I think the overriding problem is not visionary leadership. It's how we fund schools in our nation. And until we can come up with a way to fund schools where the burden is not on the taxpayer's shoulders, we're going to have inequity in how schools are not only funded, but the offerings that we give to children. I think that it's just criminal that children in some districts get a wonderful education, and 7 miles away, they have to have reading in the corner of the library because their tax base will not hold a referendum. The way that we fund schools is, Jonathan Kozel has a book called Savage Inequalities that talks about the way we fund schools in our nation. And I think that's really the bottom line. I mean, charismatic, visionary leadership is absolutely essential to pass a referendum, but the overriding problem is that no one right now is thinking they're all our children, that we're responsible for all of them, no matter where they live.
Mm-hmm. Professor Correa?
Well, she sounds like a wonderful building principal, I got to tell you. Mm-hmm. I also think it's interesting because I had written down savage inequalities on a notepad in front of me right before she mentioned that. So very aware of that. Certainly, our model of funding schools with property taxes goes back to the Northwest Ordinance, and that was where property was set aside to raise funding for schools in the Northwest part of the United States back in the 1780s and 90s, and then as it spread westward. That basic philosophy of funding through property tax revenue generation is still with us today. It really isn't effective. She is absolutely correct. This issue needs to be addressed. However, to get it on people's radar and to be able to talk about that in a politically expedient way is something that we haven't quite figured out how to do, and that political leadership has got to step forward to be able to address this. This is not a need that is just an inconvenience. This is nearing the criminal in a lot of places with the inequity in what happens. But again, the problem is communicating this, packaging this in a way so that it would be important. I would also say that I don't necessarily think we need charismatic leadership. I'm more suspicious of that than most other kind. I just think we need to have leadership that's able to communicate within this climate what we can do. Now, if we're going to change the climate, I agree that needs to be done in the funding mechanism. That would be an important and valuable contribution to school future.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Deborah, for the call. John in Hartford, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I would like to echo the comments previously made by the Antioch administrator. I'm one of those central office administrators. And I think in some respects, we're just treating the causes and not the symptoms. And the symptoms would be the inability of the state or the unwillingness of the state to reexamine the way it does fund schools. For instance, in the 80s, there were large tax breaks given to manufacturing as incentives. And the breaks that were given to industry and manufacturing were transferred to homeowners. So a larger burden of the taxation fell on homeowners. Also, we have huge unfunded mandates. For instance, our special education programs are funded probably about 30 cents on a dollar. Our bilingual cultural programs, 16 cents on a dollar, and yet we're mandated to provide services.
Yeah. Professor Correa.
The gentleman's exactly correct. What we expect schools to do with static budgets and an increasing rollout of unfunded mandates, the special education is a classic one. That was guaranteed to be near 100% or 100% funding. The reality, I thought that was kind of generous at 30 cents on the dollar. Most evidence shows that to be much less than that. Take assessment, standardized testing, no child left behind requirements,
et cetera, et cetera. Then you still have to turn on the lights and heat the building. School teacher salaries, you know, all these other things going on. Schools do a phenomenal job with what they've got. However, the result of that is what happened on Tuesday, where you have this unprecedentedly high number looking simply for operating money, mm-hmm. not to expand programs. And that streams to school funding, and that takes political leadership. So somehow that has got to be able to, we've got to be able to appeal to those, our political leaders, to be able to address this issue.
Well, we'll address the issue again at another time. Lots of interest in this topic, Professor Correa. Thanks a lot for being with us.
I'm very glad you're...
Oh, we lost you there for a second. Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Thanks to Leo Duran for producing the program and to Karen Prager for on-air production. Thank you for listening. You know that you can listen to our talk shows anytime, your convenience, through your computer. We archive them all, and you can find them on the website, WPR.org, WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.